translation by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. By further transformation of the mode of passion, the sense organs like the ear, skin, nose, eyes, tongue, mouth, hands, genitals, legs, and the outlet for evacuating, together with intelligence and living energy, are all generated. Purport: the living condition in material existence depends more or less on one's intelligence and powerful living energy. Intelligence to counteract the hard struggle for existence is assisted by the senses for acquiring knowledge, and the living entity maintains himself by manipulating the active organs like the hands and legs. But on the whole, the struggle for existence is an exertion of the mode of passion. Therefore, all the sense organs, headed by intelligence and the living entity, prana, are different products and byproducts of the second mode of nature called passion. This mode of passion, however, is the product of the air element, as described before. Om Jnanati Mirandasya Jnananjana Shlakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So this is a nice series of intricate verses in this chapter, chapter 5, which deals with aspects of sarga, primary creation, those items which are created by the Supreme Lord Himself. As we know, there are two stages in creation, or two aspects, the primary creation and the secondary creation. And the primary creation is everything that is manifested by the Supreme Lord Vishnu. Ultimately, Krishna, in one of his multiple expansions, Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, Kshirodakshaya Vishnu, Karunadakshaya Vishnu, these are the original three Purushas. And these Purushas, Krishna, Vishnu, they are the cause of the initial ingredients, phenomena, and supporting items that are required for the world to work. If we consider any manufacturing in this world, it always uses some raw ingredients, some forces, some energies, situations. And so when Brahma has to actually begin the task of secondary creation, he needs some ingredients to work with. So the Lord here manifests all these ingredients. And this part is being described by Lord Brahma. Because Lord Brahma is explaining how it is that, he's explaining who is actually supreme. Brahma is typically accepted as the creator in this universe. But that's not the full story. Because Brahma is the secondary creator. So he's explaining all the creation that takes place before he starts his work. So this is a nice mood that we give due acknowledgement to predecessors prior to any activity we may perform. Even if that activity is very, very powerful, we should always acknowledge the work that was done by others before. So when we actually, and this has many parallels in our preaching, in our discussions, in our attempts to bring people to Krishna consciousness, we might think, I distributed a book to this person and I made this person a devotee. Well, the chances are a lot happened before that also. Before someone actually becomes a devotee, before someone develops the adhikar to become attracted to spiritual life, they may well have done a great deal in previous lives by the assistance of many great persons, by the Supreme Lord's mercy himself. And so it is always very useful to see ourselves as nothing more than an instrument, a subservient instrument in the big scheme of the Lord's plan. Now, Brahma certainly has a lot to do to manifest the universe and make it a suitable environment for all the living entities is no easy thing. Just to establish a temple is extremely difficult. To set up a company is challenging. To set up maybe a country or political institution is very difficult also. So let's just consider the task that Brahma has ahead of him to set up the universe, the planetary systems, and then to manifest all the conditions that the spirit souls will enter into, all the bodies, all the species of life, and then to use the Lord's created ingredients and energies and make them accessible. So here we hear of certain key concepts that have to be made first. When Brahma creates, he uses a blueprint made by the Lord. The Lord has already envisaged the entire creation, and therefore he creates, as an example in today's verse, modes, the modes of nature, passion, ignorance, goodness, and here in particular he creates sense organs, which are supposed to be just suitable for the living entity to interact with the material world. Now the living entity is in an odd position, because the living entity is spiritual by nature. It is a part of Krishna, mama evamso jiva loke, jiva bhuta sanatana. It is a little amsha of Krishna, a little spark of spiritual energy. But the problem is that when the spark of spiritual energy decides to be independent from the Lord and decides to control and to lord it over something, the Lord has to create that something. And that something is this material world, nature. And this nature is the opposite of the living entity. The living entity is Satchit Ananda, eternal, full of knowledge, full of bliss. And everything in this world is by definition the opposite. Because that's what we wanted. We wanted a situation that we could control. So something has to be made which is inferior to us, ultimately. But just in order for us to be able to function here, we need a whole packaging. Because the spirit soul on its own, floating around in this world of matter, could not do anything. Because it is spirit, and matter is matter, with opposite properties. So therefore, a whole series of layers has to be created. And therefore we have the subtle body, mind, intelligence, and ego. And we have the gross body, with everything that's described here, with the senses, the organs, the five elements. And so this is the elaborate creation that the Lord does, just in order to facilitate us, to allow us to function. So all these items have been contemplated, and it's not that Brahma suddenly decided, okay, I will make some species, and I will make the sense of hearing, the sense of sight, sense of touch. No, what he's doing is he's taking these principles and blueprints already designed by the Lord. The Lord has already energized these concepts for the world. And Brahma then works with those to manifest these specific organs or situations. So if we look at some of the things that are mentioned, first thing that's mentioned is that it is the mode of passion that transforms into these sense organs. And this word sense should probably be discussed a little bit, because the way Srila Prabhupada uses the word sense is not the common usage of it. A sense, as we understand, is a sense of touch, sense of sight, sense of hearing. It's an activity almost. But the way it's described here, indriya, refers to an actual instrument or an organ. So this list that we read out as part of the translation is actually broken down into two parts. Karmendriya and Gyanendriya. Indriya is the word for, which is translated as sense. It might be useful to consider it more like instrument in this case. So you have these instruments, and you have the Gyanendriyas, which are knowledge-acquiring instruments, and then you have the Karmendriyas, which are active instruments. So what's the difference? Well, the knowledge-acquiring instruments are sensory. They give us sensory experience. The eyes, these are all the organs, the eyes, the ears, the tongue, the skin, and what else? The nose, for smell. So these five, these are the ways by which we experience the world around us. Fragrances, sights, smells, sounds, tastes. And this is how we receive information. But then in order to act in this world, we have active organs. And these are items like the hands. We can do things with the hands. The legs. We can move with the legs. Then parts of our digestive process, reproductive system, speech, the tongue. These are all the active components that allow us to interact with the world. Just imagine if either of those was missing, you wouldn't have a functioning entity. You would either be able to act but have no sensory experience, so it could be like a robot with no senses, or you could have senses but you couldn't do anything. So you would literally be just there. Maybe a tree is perhaps the closest you could imagine to that situation. I mean, a tree does have certain actions also, certain activities within itself, but largely it doesn't have external senses like arms and legs by which it can manipulate the world around it. So this series is essential. You can see it's a masterpiece of design by the Lord, that he's given us all these five ways that we are going to receive information. And those five ways, which are senses, those would have no value if the Lord hadn't previously created items that we will perceive through those means. So if there was nothing to, if the phenomenon of light wasn't there, the phenomenon of receiving spatial awareness through light, there would be no point having an eye, for example. There would be no point having an ear if there was not pressure waves and sound and auditory possibilities. If there was no fragrance, evaporation, there would be nothing to smell, nothing to taste. If there wasn't liquid with all its innumerable actions, you couldn't taste, you couldn't drink, you couldn't do any of those things. So you see, with the senses, the whole thing is a combined masterpiece. That's why this idea of evolution is so distasteful. At best, even if an item of evolution is considered, it's an evolution within an environment which has already been created. Or an environment which, did that evolve? That's not described as part of evolution. Even if you accept the ideas that, you know, species evolve, one transforms into another, I mean, that could be discussed in so many ways itself, but it's all linked to the atmosphere, to the environment. If there was not the physics of radiation, electromagnetic waves, so many items that have been evolved, so to say, simply would have no value. So the whole thing is a masterpiece. And then you, if you remember your studies of geography and ecology and whatever, there are so many cycles in nature. Nitrogen cycle, oxygen cycle, carbon dioxide cycle, they all work harmoniously. And you'll probably remember being tormented by all of these things when you had to learn them for exams. But it just, water cycle, it just lets us know that the world is a complex, engineered situation. It's not something random, and it's certainly not something that evolved without intelligence. And here we are learning about the intelligence that was involved. And it's of two types: the Lord himself, then empowerment by Brahma, which is another type of intelligence, which seeks and aims to manifest the world. So from the mode of passion, these different items arise. And also interestingly, it mentions intelligence and living energy. So living energy is called in this verse prana. So this is like life airs. We will hear the word prana used translated as life air. So it said that within the body, this is part of the facilitation of the soul in this world. There are five types of air moving within the body: prana, apana, udana, vyana. And so these facilitate. These actually carry the soul, it is said. The soul floats in these airs. That's the term Prabhupada uses somewhere. And it floats within these airs, and these carry out different functions, or they're used in different ways. The organs interact with these airs. And the science of Ayurveda is based upon keeping things in balance. When these airs go out of balance, when the organs are, certain components are out of balance, people experience varying types of disease. So in one place, Srila Prabhupada says that when there is an imbalance of the airs, one can suffer from different types of mental disease. Because for mental equilibrium and steadiness of our being, we need all of these things to be functioning smoothly. Then, of course, when that develops, then the organs also suffer because they depend on the correct circulation of the airs. And through that, disease comes, of physical types of disease. So to actually deal with the concepts of disease, one has to consider a more holistic approach. Yes, certainly Western medicine, medicine in general, has made great advances in dealing with certain types of illness. Certain things are very effective, operations are very effective, and they deal with that gross aspect. They deal with the gross body and manipulation of it and control of it. But there is another dimension which is not so comprehensively understood, and that is the whole mental realm. And there is very little, you can say, competent understanding of it. There are very, very blunt tools that are available in medical science to deal with any disorders of the mind or anything like that. They're very, very blunt and very vague. And so you could hardly say it is a comprehensive situation. And that's because the comprehensive understanding is not there. That there is a soul supported by five types of air, and that functions within the body, and that subtle body, mind, intelligence, and ego, which is manifested through this mode of passion, is the first covering of the living entity. And then the organs and everything around it, the elements, this is the second covering. Now, it's interesting that the Bhagavatam goes into such detail about some of the elements and the physical situation, despite the fact that the Bhagavatam's real goal is not that. The Bhagavatam's goal is something else. Now, in the Gita, it explains that bhumi rapo analo vayu kammano buddhirevacha ahankara iti amme bhinna prakriti rashtada. That earth, fire, air, water, ether, these constitute my separate material energies. Mind, intelligence, and ego. So, in the Gita, these elements are analyzed in eight types. Right? The gross elements, and then these three subtle elements. Now, throughout the Bhagavatam, you will find different levels of lists. That's a list of eight, which is a way to conduct Sankhya on the world, to conduct analysis on the world. Eight. In this kind of analysis, you will have maybe 16 elements, if you include all the senses, if you include the active senses. So you can divide it, and a final list could be 24. So these are different levels of, you could say, revelation, or different levels of detail. But they all basically describe that there are material elements. So the Gita continues, Aparayamitasvanyam prakritim vidhime param jiva bhuta mahabayo baho yayedam dhariyate jagat. It says that, but there is superior to these five elements and the three subtle elements, there is something else. And that is the jiva, the soul. Aparayam itasvanyam prakritim vidhime param jiva bhuta mahabaho. It is mahabaho, it is much more powerful, stronger than any of these elements. And that is the real purpose of this entire facilitation. This vehicle, this body, these components, these elements have all been made in order to facilitate the highest thing, which is the jiva. So it is said that indriyani paranyahur indriyebhya parammana. What's next? Manasastu parabuddhir yo buddhe paratastu saha. The dull working senses are superior to matter, right? The mind is superior to the senses, and the intelligence is superior to the mind. And then, ultimately, the soul is superior to all of those. So the Gita goes through this, gives the hierarchy of this, and you can see how to have a comprehensive hierarchy. You need some details of matter, because after all, we survive in matter, and matter is all around us. Prakriti is one of the elements of this world. It's also one of the, well, it is the world. It is one of the elements of our existence in the conditioned state. And so prakriti is one of the topics, one of the five topics of the Gita also. So prakriti is very important. And so when the Bhagavatam goes through details, and certainly you've been reading and hearing these discussions over the last few weeks, they are quite intricate, quite confusing also. And they're given in a very brief manner, a very overview style. The purpose of the Bhagavatam is not to give us precise technical information that we can then use to try to exploit material nature. That's the standard behavior of the living entity anyway. Maya dakshena prakriti suyate sacharacharam. Right? And one is situated in this realm of maya, and typically one acts prakrite kriyamanani gunai karmani sarvashah ahankara vimuratma karta aham iti manyate. Situated and bewildered, the living entity considered himself to be the doer of activities, which are actually carried out by nature. It's actually nature supplying all the energy, all the facility. But we are so proud, we think, I am doing so many things. So the Bhagavatam doesn't try to reinforce that. So the Bhagavatam doesn't give you precise technical information from which you could then build some gadget that would allow you to exploit the material world. It doesn't really do that explicitly. There is enough information, enough essence of it, but it is not fully developed. So in the past you would have additional shastras as well, which would give more information on how to do manipulations and things like that. And so you have a shastra for fighting. There are different items which teach you the science of weapons. Now, even if we consider weapons, we are practically only aware of one type of weapon today. That's fire-based weapons. But there are five elements, and there are five types of weapons possible. Water weapons, earth weapons, but we have no real understanding of those. Basically, everything that we have as a weapon is basically something that explodes, fire-based. That's it, basically. Nothing else. So, you can see how the Bhagavatam gives details which make complete sense. But they're not a physics manual or a guide to subatomic physics or anything like that. You won't directly get that. We as devotees, we have the idea that Bhagavatam is the complete picture of existence for us. It does contain complete knowledge of the material world. We could say it contains complete seed knowledge on multiple topics. And so that knowledge, when it is expanded with the correct intelligence and the correct approach, can actually also be used for many material things. But because the Bhagavatam's purpose is not that, it is given in a very covered way, and in a way which emphasizes the spiritual aspect. Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda ki, Shri Shri Gornitai ki, Shri Shri Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman ki. So when we read these descriptions, we understand what a complex being we are. We understand what we are made of, and we understand ultimately, through this scripture, what our purpose is. This machine was created, it has a purpose. A car is created, it has a purpose. A plane exists, it has a purpose. So this entire cosmic creation, which facilitates us, can altogether be considered like a vehicle for a purpose. And if we understand the purpose, we can fulfill the purpose of human life. So Prahlad Maharaj says, and we celebrated Lord Hiranyakashipu's demise on Sunday, and the appearance of Lord Narsingadev. And so Prahlad Maharaj says, he says, Nate vidu svartha gatim hi vishnum durashaya ye bahirarthamaninas andhayathande rupaniyamanas te pishatantriyamurudam nibaddha. Prahlad Maharaj explains that in this world, people are by nature desirous of contacting the senses, bahir. They're interested in externals, things that are bahi, outside. It refers to all the sense objects. And so he says, in this world what happens is, a person who is attracted to sense enjoyment accepts a certain guru. And he says, he accepts a guru who themselves is as attracted or addicted to sense objects. Now what success happens as a result of this? Well, the answer is no success at all. The analogy is given that the situation being described here is similar to a blind man taking shelter of another blind man to lead them and direct them. And the verse describes that what happens is that they fall into a ditch, both of them. The blind man leads the other blind man straight into a ditch, and no success takes place. No root is achieved. So when this happens, when someone takes shelter of someone who is themselves attached, strongly attached to the sense objects, they are bound by ropes of fruitive labor. That's how Prabhupada translates it. They're bound by ropes of fruitive labor, and they continue bound in this world again and again and again, life after life. So there is absolutely no meaning to a guru, to accepting a guru or a teacher or an instructor who is themselves attached to sense enjoyment. You can see from this verse, these senses are elaborate. You know, five senses, such a complex system. To actually be detached from those is not such an immediately obvious task. It's possible, definitely possible, and that's one of the challenges, and that's one of the purposes of human life, to demonstrate that we would like to move beyond this state of simply just running after the nearest sense object that comes across our vision. Whatever it is, we do this day in, day out, from the moment we wake up, and from the moment we were born, practically, we've been chasing sense objects. But the fact is that if we continue to do that, we don't make any advancement. And this is why in the Nectar of Instruction it is explained that a person who is actually qualified to lead others is a person who is themselves able to control the different urges of sense gratification. Vacho vegam, manasah krodha vegam, jivva vegam, udara upashta vegam. They're all referring to these senses. Udara, upashta, genitals. Etan megan yo vishaheta dhira, sarvam apimnam prithivim shashishyat. Such a person can be the spiritual master for the entire world. And so this is a prime prerequisite. That anyone who can take us out of this world has to be not entrapped in this world themselves. Now we're all trying, and probably we're thinking, yes, I've got some, it's quite a long way to go before I could consider myself to be free of attachment. And yes, definitely it's a work in progress. So while that work is going on, it doesn't mean we stop preaching. We can repeat the message of the acharyas. We can repeat the need to become free from sense gratification. We can repeat those messages. We can explain them to the extent that we've understood them, to the extent that is possible. And simultaneously, we should also be trying to practice them. And so that's why in a devotee's life, they try to keep their life simple. Now sometimes, we don't always manage. We still end up with tons of items. Dravya shakti is quite strong in this world. It is the item, it is the shakti that produces, manifests items based upon the five elements. And so we acquire items. Then in our mind and intelligence, there is a complex network of possessions also. In fact, to collect knowledge is another type of collection. That's also there. Some people just want to collect more and more and more knowledge. That's also a type of sense enjoyment. And some people are attached to mental speculations. That's another type of enjoyment. And so when we look at it on the subtle level and the gross level, we have many items which still bind us. But we have the ultimate person who can cut all our knots of attachment if we just allow him to. When the living entity tries to come towards Krishna, there's a little bit of a cutting process required to disentangle us from the complicated meshes of birth and death. And the holy name is our prime weapon for doing so. So we have the holy name, apana samsritim ghoram yan nama vivashogranan tato satyo vimucheta yad bibheti swayam bayam, that those who are entangled in the complicated meshes of birth and death can be saved by the chanting of the holy name. Just the chanting, the utterance of the holy name can unentangle, disentangle one from all their spaghetti-like state, wrapped up amidst sense objects. And it's really, it's a complicated situation. And then simultaneously we try to do that internally, ourselves, by just trying to be simpler, trying to not artificially complicate things. Trying to just follow the process, chanting the holy name, reading scripture, having a sublime life, peaceful. And that way we control all these different urges of anger, urges of sense gratification. And the theory is, or it should be our conviction, not just a theory, the conviction should be that by Krishna's mercy we will be able to overcome these insurmountable obstacles by his mercy. So that's what we have to look forward to. I'll stop there. See if there are any questions, comments. Yes? Antaranga. It's a good job we have Antaranga. If he was called Bahiranga, we'd have a problem.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Thank you, Prabhu, for very nice, very insightful class, very nice points. I have one question here. Prabhupada mentions in the purport, the first sentence, he goes, the living condition in material existence depends more or less on one's intelligence and powerful living energy. Mm. So can you elaborate on the fact how intelligence is important for us to overcome the material nature? How should we as practicing devotees should sort of train this muscle of intelligence?
Yeah. The first thing to realize is that our intelligence is faulty. That's the first step. We know from the Gita that this disease of lust has captured three points in our body. The senses. What are the three sitting places of lust? The senses, the mind, and the intelligence. And these are like strategic places within the body. They've been captured, infected. And so we have a problem as a result of this. So you can see how liberating these three items from the contamination of lust is key, obviously, to becoming pure, to becoming purified. So Prabhupada says that intelligence to counteract the hard struggle for existence, that's what we need to develop. Then he says that that is assisted by the senses. So what once we realize that we have been infected and that our intelligence is not functioning correctly, in one sense, we have to make a concerted effort to replace it with something more functional. Not necessarily replace it altogether, but to purify it, to mold it, to have it enhanced. We need to undergo some intellectual surgery to enhance its capabilities. And so we take our intelligence ultimately from Krishna. Krishna supplies us intelligence. But then, of course, that comes to us. I mean, some people like to think Krishna speaks to them in dreams or in their minds. Yes, that could happen. Super soul is there. Sometimes thoughts come to us, and they could be directly from Krishna. But largely the process is that it comes through his authorized system, which is his representatives, the parampara, the six Goswamis, our acharyas, Srila Prabhupada, our spiritual masters, and the whole assembly of devotees. That is how we actually get new intelligence. New intelligence that gives us a purified way to look at the world. And so that cleansing of the intelligence is carried out through Shastra, through reading Shastra, to contemplating it. Doesn't it say in the Gita that one who reads and studies this sacred conversation of mine, worships me with his intelligence? That is what just connecting ourselves to Shastra can do. We engage our intelligence and the intelligence is purified. Then the process of chanting the holy name purifies all aspects, because its job is to free us from the complicated meshes that we spoke about. So it acts on all the three components. Our regulative principles help also. They help by physical restriction. Okay, that's one layer. But you can only carry on with physical restriction for so long. You need to develop the subtle strength as well. The intelligence has to become strong. The mind has to become strong. The ego has to become correctly situated at the lotus feet of Krishna. Because then, following the regulative principles is not really a problem. Because you see them as something advantageous. We see them as regulative principles of freedom, because they free us from being under the dictates of our mind. Most people have completely surrendered to their mind. They worship their mind. Whatever my mind produces, I should immediately fulfill it. And I'm a successful human being if I have the sufficient means in order to fulfill whatever my mind has concocted. I want to conquer this land. Okay, I should have sufficient arms, intelligence, forces in order to do so. Then I'm a successful human being. But actually that thought just came into the mind. Or I want to build the largest business empire in the world. And therefore I should be expert at monetary manipulation and salesmanship and whatever it is that's required to do so. Whatever it is that a person wants. But did they consider whether what they wanted was worthwhile in the first place? People are helplessly, or you could say hopelessly, serving whatever pops into their mind. But do they stop to consider whether that is actually worthwhile, worth expending our energy for? And that's where spiritual life gives you that perspective, through intelligence. Through intelligence we discriminate which is a good thought, which is not a good thought.
Sorry, if I may ask one more question, Prabhu, sorry for... The majority of the population on this planet is very much on the level of the senses and on the level of the mind. So how can we as creatures of Krishna consciousness present this philosophy in a such a way that people in general are willing to accept it? Because sometimes when you utilize intelligence and present intelligent kind of a points, they're just not willing to accept. Mm. So how should we meditate on present the philosophy in a way that is accepted?
Well, the acceptance part is not down to us. That's not in our control. That's part of Krishna's side of the equation, the result side. Our part is the effort side. So the effort that we make in order to convey in the best way possible the mercy that we've received. We have to be so appreciative of Krishna's mercy. And we have to value it so much in our lives that we make a sincere effort to practice it on a daily basis. That when we speak to someone and encourage them to move away from the path of sense gratification, it has some gravity and substance. So a person who is themselves enjoying their senses, connecting their senses to sense objects in a large way, is hardly going to inspire someone else to do the opposite. So there's all those components that we ourselves have to practice it to the best of our ability. And then sometimes the effectiveness can happen after a period of time. It can happen after many years. Could possibly be that maybe in this life we preach throughout our life and Krishna doesn't give us much visible success. But then in a future life, we start preaching and devotees appear out of the corners. Could be like that. And again, we have to remember that we are the instrument. So how Krishna wants to use us through whichever means is the key thing. And not so much what is achieved by my specific efforts. But the main thing is we just try. We should try and not be trying. Some people are trying, you know, he's very trying. That means he causes trouble. But we should try to actually help people come to a very deep platform of spiritual life. Yes, Prajan Prabhu?
It reminds me of the verse, how we can use these senses. Sarvaupadim vinirmuktam tapar vinanirmanam hirsikesa rishikesa sevanam bhakti uchate. By using the senses in the service of the Lord, there's a dynamic change, and we could say under guidance. And who tells us what to do? It's our Shiksha Guru. So in that way, we have to be educated at the same time, or given instruction to use these senses all in the service of the Lord, making a positive package, because we can't do it on our own. We can't just say, oh, we're engaging my senses in the service of the Lord. It has to be under direction. And yes. That's what I was thinking. Another sense.
Yes, very nice point.
Yeah.
Yes, Rasaraj, Krishna Prabhu.
Thank you for the class, Prabhu. You were mentioning the life as the five lives, life as, and this is like a type of pranayama. You can control your mental disorders or physical disorders by controlling your life as, and with that's part of like Ashtanga yoga, you know, doing asanas, doing pranayama, and we sometimes devotees may even get into these things like pranayama and asana because it's a way of healing themselves while practicing Krishna consciousness. Should devotees be, or should we have that inclination or idea to actually help ourselves in devotional service by using pranayama and asana and things like that, if we have the right intention?
Yes, we should be prepared to use anything that will help us come to Krishna. Now, certainly, some things are forbidden, right? Certain things we don't go towards. You know, we're not going to start eating meat or this or that, something like that, something that's gross and very destructive. But if we're prepared to take antibiotics, if we're prepared to take medicines, if we're prepared to take so many things, if we exercise, if we go for a swim, if we run, we play sports, what's the disqualification of pranayama as part of that whole package? The problem comes if someone elevates pranayama or hatha yoga or anything like that to the status of devotional life, to the equivalent status of bhakti. But we do so many things on a daily basis which are just for our routine maintenance. So why not take shelter of proven methodologies if they are proven and if you are instructed by a competent person? There's enough speculation going on. There's enough so-called Ayurvedic experts. Generally, most people, when they go into an Ayurvedic consultation, the person will tell them, you have a problem with your liver. It's almost like the first thing that comes out. And sometimes you wonder whether the person telling you this even understands what the liver is. You know, so you have to be a little careful. There's a lot of so-called remedies and authoritative stuff which feeds off people's desire to have a simple, holistic, ancient therapy. But sadly, some of the practitioners are well short of the mark today. They haven't developed their competence in the lineage that it's supposed to come in. There is a sort of a parampara for these things as well. And so these ancient techniques are passed down with the proper shastra. But if you can learn some techniques that will help, then certainly breath control, yam, niyam, asana, dharana, pratyahara, these are the initial stages. Pranayama is a part of that process. And it's only one of the stages of the yogic process to calm the mind, to keep the mind peaceful. So we can definitely utilize it. But if you spend your japa period doing pranayama or doing hatha yoga, something is wrong. Because that time is for japa. And if you're not before the Lord, chanting His holy name, preaching, because you're spending 3 hours a day doing something else, there's a problem. But we spend an hour eating every day, hour, maybe more, 2 hours. So why not spend some time doing something that will help our constitution also? Yes, Prabhuji?
If I can just come in on that point, if I may. Excellent class, by the way. Very fantastic. I think one of the things maybe to say there is already in the Gita, we know a little bit that yoga is not the supreme path. Yoga is, my understanding, is the karma path, and both the karma path and the yoga path, especially in Kali Yuga, are not successful paths. So maybe that's not such a great thing to be concentrating on pranayama. I think also Rupa Goswami has kind of outlined to us the processes that we can take in bhakti, right? So we listen, we remember, and these, how many points are there? 11, right? Nine.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Rashashru, anything from the ladies? Yes?
Yeah, sorry. We also see in devotee communities healing centers and maybe therapy, like devotee care, like systems, you know, so people can go and, like, you know, talk about their certain problems, be checked by certain people who are maybe qualified in certain psychophysical areas. What is your opinion on that compared to Srila Prabhupada's beginning of Krishna consciousness? Anything that he would say, maybe?
Prabhupada was very, very concerned about the health of his disciples. We have numerous occasions when he would sometimes even interrupt a sort of a spiritual situation, you know, something's going on, in order to ask the person about their welfare. And he would give practical advice also, which often was from Ayurveda, or often from dietary perspective, or some practical aspect to do with life. So Prabhupada learnt all those things from somewhere. So in a society, we also need to have those things taught. What are those bases which constitute healthy living? So there is, and it also fits into a devotee's compassionate nature. But it is not the devotee's first job description. See, in this world, there are so many things we do. Everyone living in a house as a grihastha works. They go to a company. They do some job. Maybe they produce some products. Maybe they sell some services. There is a whole range of things people do on a daily basis to maintain their body, to keep themselves, keep body and soul together, as it were. So we should not exclude any wholesome items either. If you want to exclude everything, yes, fine. Give it all up. Have complete faith in Krishna. Give up maintaining your home. Be more like Srivas Thakur, Kolevecha Sridhar. If you can do that, then yes. So we have to have a balanced perspective. Yes, we need basic society to function also. When it functions with Krishna consciousness as its source and guiding principle, great things can happen. But if a devotee's agenda starts to go down a path of material welfare activity, philanthropy, that is a problem. Because spiritual life is that treatment that will save them from birth and death. It will save them from whatever the disease they've got. Again, in the future. Future life. It will save them from those problems continuously. So the effect is much greater. But we also have a duty to be kind and caring. And we can exhibit that. People can exhibit that. Okay, you could go to your company, and you could do a job where you earn money, you consult some person, how you give some consultancy services in how this company could make more money, be more profitable, be more efficient. And the end result is it's someone's balance sheet that you're assisting through that process. But if you maybe set up some clinic to help someone, gave them some techniques of Ayurveda-based help, even standard medicine, but taught them how to be kind, why is that less of a worthy profession than the profession of a city operative? But if you say that the profession of a brahmachari preacher is equivalent to a person who does that role, then that would be wrong. I don't mean a brahmachari necessarily in the ashram, I mean a preacher of Krishna consciousness, one who practices brahmachari, which is for all ashrams. So there is we have to keep that distinction clear. What are pure spiritual activities? And then we also have to accept the huge range of non-pure spiritual activities that we routinely do. And then we should perhaps try to enhance those with other material activities which are endorsed in the scripture, in our shastras like Ayurveda and other places, which can assist in a better way our spiritual progress. This bharam, you know, Prahlad Maharaj speaks about this bharam, udvahato vimudhan. This bharam, this great ugra karma-based activities that we do. This highly industrialized, mechanized, intense, anger-based production. This doesn't create a peaceful mindset for society in general that makes it conducive for spiritual life. So if we can teach devotees how to conduct their professions in a simpler, more peaceful way, that will be of great benefit also. Because that's one of the goals of ISKCON, that's one of Prabhupada's goals, to bring people together with the purpose of teaching them a simpler, more natural way of life. So that should be part of our vision for society in general. That we want the whole of society to be uplifted. And that does include dharma, artha, kama, moksha. Those are required elements in any society. And we have to just learn to teach people how to do those in as wholesome and as simple a manner as possible. Prabhuji?
Thank you.
Just have another question that sprung up, Prabhu. Let's say there is a devotee who happened to be expert at working in the city or something like that, and he's able to make a bunch of Lakshmi and maybe bring that to assist with maybe buying some farms or whatever is required as part of his spiritual master's vision. Would you consider that to be a valid and worthwhile profession still, or should he maybe give that up and set up a...
Whatever profession one has, one continues. Stane stita shruti gadam, right? That's the injunction. Don't try to change things unnecessarily. People study, they enter a profession, they conduct their profession. The main point is, are you using the fruits for service? It very rarely happens that someone adopts a particular profession with the goal that I will now make a lot of money and offer it to Krishna. They might make a lot of money, but they very rarely offer it to Krishna. So that is the crux of it. That a person enters into a certain idea with a motivation or an excuse, it's almost an excuse. It's an excuse where they justify to themselves doing it, and they never actually reap the fruits of it, or never fulfill it, consummate it properly. So that's simply trickery. But if someone is in that profession, and they are competent, and they offer a huge amount to Krishna for service, they could sponsor welfare activities, they could sponsor things that help people become better situated, that's excellent. We don't stop that. We need Prabhupada set up the life membership program specifically for this purpose. That he wanted everyone. And such great things can be done when you have help from all aspects of society. ISKCON is not a little corner of something, you know? We don't hide in our temple and that's it. It's the philosophy we have is about varna and ashram. All the four varnas are important. All the four ashrams are important. We have to be represented in all aspects of society. Industry, commerce, all those things. Thank you. Okay, yes, Prabhuji?
My question is, what's your vision...
Just use the mic so others can...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What's your vision of society in the next 10 years with everything that's happening now?
Predicting the future is always difficult. But we know what won't change. What won't change is people's greed and desire to continue enjoying the senses. That's the root principle. So we can only guess as to how that will manifest. We can see different trends in society. We can see a trend towards increasing technological immersion. We can see a trend towards aversion to any type of austerity. No one wants to experience a bit of hard graft or a bit of difficulty. They try to resolve it as quickly as possible with great effort, expense, complication. Those trends will continue. But we also are at a very interesting and optimistic, and it's quite optimistic, that people in the world do have an appreciation that the way things are going is not the full or correct picture. Our economies, especially in the last 2 or 3 years, have been sustained on a completely artificial basis since COVID came in. It's monetary manipulation. And people can see the problems that that causes. It's happened in history multiple times. It continues to happen today. It will just repeat itself. The end result is that people will become increasingly dissatisfied. So you can see when people are dissatisfied, that will lead to problems, social problems. That will increase. People will turn to quick fix methods. They will try an increasing array of substances. Governments will start legalizing more and more substances because it's the only way they can try to control something. There's that dimension. And amidst that whole mess, that chaotic scene, some people are realizing that our exploitation of Mother Nature has to stop. It cannot continue like this. So people are becoming vegans. People are having greater environmental consciousness. People are trying to do something. Sometimes they do it in a small way. Many, many people are turning to spiritual life, or at least exploring it. And so this is one of the very important things that temples like this do. They give people a chance to come and to have a little taste or gain a little experience of an alternative reality. Something different to what the normal world gives you. And people try that. And if that continues, that's excellent. And we can do our bit by just giving the holy name to as many people as possible. Because that will really touch their hearts. And over time, we will see things transform. So what I see coming ahead is it's a mixture of pain and opportunity for hope as well.
To follow up with that, I have another question, which was, if I generally believe that lately I've been thinking that since I came here, literally realized this is the main religion or the belief in God, let's say. But I was thinking, nowadays, probably 80% of people or 70% of people, they don't really believe in God. So would you say that God would not be happy because He created us? So therefore we stop believing in Him and now we want to be our own gods? Would you say that some kind of punishment or something is coming for us?
Well, the punishment is this world. That is the punishment. The punishment is this world. But it's a world where it's not direct punishment in that sense. You have the opportunity. You are in this environment of karma. You have the opportunity to have some enjoyment. But you also have the opportunity to create your own distress. So it's not that God needs to impose some special punishment on us. We're happily doing it anyway. We are destroying the world, we're creating a hellish life for ourselves, and even if in this life we don't experience it, it's coming to us next. When we take another birth, maybe as a human, maybe as another species, the world is going to be worse than it is now. It's not going to be in a better situation, really, unless major things change. So the desire to be independent is itself what caused us to be in this world. And now our actions determine what will happen next. So in one sense, it's not God as a vindictive individual imposing anything on us. We have the choice. According to how we behave now, we are literally creating our future. So this is a unique aspect which is essential for spiritual life. And actually most religions do not have this as a fundamental concept. The concept of karma and reincarnation. It is absolutely key to understanding how it is that one person in this life has, you know, as we say, is born with a silver spoon in their mouth, has all facilities, all luxuries, and another person is struggling, is born in the middle of a war perhaps, and is living in fear of their life with nothing to eat maybe every day of the life. I don't mean just the recent war, it's many countries in the world fit this description. That can happen to anyone. To make sense of that, we have to understand what caused those situations. And it wasn't God saying, you will now suffer, and you will be happy, because it's what I can do. No, these persons, through their actions, create their future for them. And so taking responsibility for ourselves is a very important step. And so when we learn that actually God is in control, it's His, He's the manifester of this world. He's Bhoktaram Yajnatapasam. He's the supreme refuge to whom everything should be offered. He's the real person. Then actually our life changes. We just get a completely different perspective. We no longer have this mood of living on the basis of exploitation. So only good things can happen when the few rare people turn towards God. Actually, Prabhupada said once, he said, we don't need millions and millions of stars. You know, he said, many people can try to come to be spiritual in a very sort of small way. He says, even if there is a presence of a few moons, you know, you can dispel so much darkness. So if a few intelligent persons take to Krishna consciousness, then the situation in the world can be just revolutionized. It can just become auspicious. So we can each play our part in that. Thank you. Okay, I think we should probably stop there. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki.